being charged to the lower end of the spectrum. At the present time, because of the tax shelter capability, the very wealthy are able to avoid paying any income tax, whereas those who don't have the money to set up an income tax shelter are paying a much higher rate. I think that the answer to that may well be some kind of a uniform rate for a certain percentage of income.
How do you feel about the super carriers? They seem like silly targets to me. A lot of money for one bomb could wipe out the whole thing.
Well, you have to examine the problem of the super carrier in three frames of reference, I think. First, in a strategic nuclear war. Anything that gets hit in a strategic nuclear war is gone, whether it be the city of Blackstone or whether it be Fort Pickens or whether it be the aircraft carrier. I'd rather be on a moving target than any fixed target once the nuclear warheads begin to fly. Some moving targets will survive, but anything that gets hit won't. A carrier is not important in a strategic nuclear war. If that's your only concern, do away with the carriers. A conventional war is the second frame of reference. In a conventional war, look at the record. In Southeast Asia, we sent carriers into the Gulf of Tonkin. They spent 9 years there. They covered the landings. They covered the withdrawals. We lost 400 aircraft destroyed by the enemy on the ground on land airfields and 4,000 damaged. The enemy never damaged an aircraft on an aircraft carrier. The Korean War, all of the land fields were overrun in the first few weeks. The aircraft carriers saved the Pusan perimeter and covered the landings at Incheon that turned the war around. You got to go all the way back to World War II to find a conventional war where the carriers were attacked. There, the oldest aircraft carrier today was the newest, the Essex class, in World War II. They were hit by as many as four of the most intelligent cruise missile we've ever had, the Kamikaze aircraft, and the Essex-class carrier never sank. Since then, the more modern carriers have had much more survivability built into them. The most recent laboratory case was the tragic fire on the nuclear carrier Enterprise, where the equivalent of 8 or 9 cruise missiles, U.S. bombs, exploded, and the Enterprise could have been back in action in a very few hours. You got to go all the way back then to the third frame of reference, a Cold War. We're giving up land fields all around the world. 1,100 at the end of World War II. We're down to about 50 overseas today. We've never had to turn an aircraft carrier over to the enemy in Cold War. And time after time in the crisis, it is the aircraft carrier that pulls our chestnuts out of the fire. Jordan, we reinforced the 6th Fleet with aircraft carriers. Yom Kippur War, we reinforced it with aircraft carriers. The Allies stood aside. Not a single Allied airfield was available to us. We were not permitted to have U.S. Air Force aircraft in Turkey or Greece. Their aircraft were not available. The aircraft carriers were the only relevant power. So in crisis after crisis, three different presidents have said to me personally the aircraft carriers were irreplaceable to them. Now, for that kind of crisis management, we can get by, in my judgment, with a cheaper variant than the multi-billion dollar beast we're building today. And I fought very hard for a sea control ship, a flat top that would carry about 17 aircraft, and we could have afforded 8 of those for the price of a nuclear aircraft carrier. The Congress killed it because it wasn't nuclear propelled, the nuclear lobby.
What can you do to, as one new senator, to compensate for this change? How much leverage can one person, a new senator, labor in changing this defense problem?
There's an immense amount that a freshman senator can do. Let me give you two examples of freshman senators who have done very good jobs. One is Senator Jim Buckley of New York, who has become one of the two great strategic nuclear experts and has done much to publicize the rapid decline in our strategic nuclear capability. The other is Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who has become quite an expert in the conventional military balance and has struck some good blows for sensible defense policies on that side. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, my opponent has never asked for a hearing to get at the facts, not even when Schlesinger was fired and known to have been fired or having tried to get the facts out. Not even after the articles by Schlesinger in the Fortune magazine appeared, or the articles by Nitze crediting the Soviets with a strategic nuclear war-winning capability. Not even after I testified in front of the Pike Committee that Kissinger has twisted the intelligence and ordered that the Secretary of State, when he was not the Secretary of State, not be informed of Soviet violations, did the Senate Armed Services Committee request a hearing. As a member of the Senate, I would demand that hearings be held on facts like that in order to publicize the true situation and to get at the generation of a consensus which can only come from public education.
General feeling of the Congress and the people in Washington about the evident power shortage that we have? Are they content with the status quo, or do they want to turn this thing around and put us on top?
The people in Washington? Well, I think, you know, that depends on who one talks to.
I'm speaking of the congressmen, people who are in a position to make changes.
Let me answer it this way. When I was Chief of Naval Operations, I tried every year to call on every member of the Congress. I averaged 85 of the 100 senators, and I averaged 350 of the 435 representatives in ones and twos and threes. They broke down, if you included the ones who wouldn't see me, into three equal categories. One third would say things like, "Look, I'm as worried as you are. Don't waste any time on me. Get out and get the others." Another third would turn off the switch when you walked in, if they would see you at all. Didn't believe that military power was relevant. Unfortunately, you could never get the Russians to share that view, but they sincerely believed that military power was irrelevant. And then there was a middle third that would say things like, "Look, I'm worried, and I believe you, but if I vote for you, I won't be here next time." And within that third, there was a subset that would go so far as to say, "Look, I've got to have a 30% a 30% pro-defense, 70% anti-defense record. You tell me which 30% to vote for." Now, they were handy to have in your hip pocket, and we saved the most important submarine system we've got, the Trident submarine, by a 49-47 vote by casting some of those proxies. But think of the immorality of a man who doesn't care what he votes for as long as I rack up a 30-70 record for him. Now, until you turn around the constituencies of that middle immoral third, you're not going to get the support for adequate defense budgets, and that means public education. And the tragedy is, and this is why I continue to talk about the dissembling of the Kissinger administration, there is what I call a disinformation process, a process of deliberately misleading the Congress and the public about what the facts are. If we could ever get ourselves a Secretary of State who was willing to be honest with us, and ever get ourselves a President who was willing to try to read deeply enough into the facts to get beyond the captive nature of his relationship to the Secretary of State, so that the American people began to see what Nitze, Schlesinger, Zumwalt, and others are saying, that we have let ourselves become number two, it'll turn around like lightning. Because there's one thing that Americans understand, and that's the difference between number one and number two. When I have traveled around in the last 2 years all around the United States visiting college campuses, I've been on about 24 now, I generally start off by saying, first, how many of you believe that we can cut our defense budgets? And almost every hand goes up. And then I ask, how many here believe we should be inferior to the Soviet Union? And only the two or three duty socialists put their hand up. The rest of them don't want to be number two, even on the campuses. And then when you proceed to explain to them what the facts are, the general reaction, even on the campus, is, why the heck aren't we doing something about it? Once the American people understand what has happened, this thing is going to turn around. But it takes getting at the facts. That's why at the Democratic National Convention, when I presented the defense platform, I came down hardest on the need for careful assessment of the facts based on a free and open system rather than the disinformation program we've had for the last 8 years.
Is this trend turning around?
This year, the Congress, for the first time, almost added some money to the President's defense budgets. They've generally averaged about $6 billion worth of cuts. That says to me that that middle third is beginning to sense from its constituencies that they're getting restless. And I think next year, after this presidential race is over, we may well see a turnaround in that picture.
Nuclear speaking, where does China fit in with us? And what is their relationship between the Soviet Union and with us?
The Chinese have got to be considered, in my judgment, as de jure members of the Communist bloc, but de facto allies of the United States. That is, for the last several years, one could have considered them that. Let me give you an example. When I was